our system is in too many ways broken.
The way we see the world shapes the way that we treat it.
We had great potential to do a lot of great things.
I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this is Making Contact. Is your children's schoolyard routinely sprayed with pesticides?
We've decided to protect children in homes, but we have decided not to protect children in rural communities.
How safe your children are might depend on where you live. Today, we hear about how and why one pesticide has been banned for household use, but still affects the health of farm workers and their children.
The pesticide manufacturers, the registrants, you know, have people here full-time whose job it is to go in and tell EPA what they think EPA should be doing.
Children's health is especially fragile, so why aren't we protecting them? To begin our show, reporter Lee Lovett takes us to Central California's farm worker communities, where a chemical called chlorpyrifos is the subject of an increasing number of studies. But despite the evidence that it can be harmful, especially to children's health, it remains legal.
In a research lab in Salinas, California, 13-year-old Brian Jimenez-Gomez is putting pegs into a slotted metal board under the watchful eye of a researcher.
Ready, go.
Brian has been taking these kinds of tests since he was a baby. His mother joined the study when she was 3 months pregnant.
All right, Brian, go ahead and pick the designs you saw from these cards. Place them in here in the same place as you saw them on the page, and let me know when you're done.
This is part of a long-term study known as Chamacos on the health effects of commonly used chemicals. Brian knows very well what happens after pesticides are sprayed in this agricultural town.
Sometimes they can be smelled, they're really strong pesticides. They can be smelled, but sometimes it's just like after a few hours or maybe a day, you start getting sick or something like that.
Chamacos stands for Center for the Health Assessment of Mothers and Children of Salinas. When the study began, researchers wanted to find out about the long-term consequences of pesticides that are toxic to the brain, among them chlorpyrifos. They came here to Monterey County, which has the highest percentage of schools and students getting the highest level of exposure to pesticides in the state. Brian's mother, Marina Gomez, has been spreading the word about this research conducted by the University of California at Berkeley.
I have spoken with a lot of families, mostly mothers. I told them, go and enroll your kids. You guys are going to know. You're going to learn more than anything how pesticides affect our kids.
Hundreds of miles inland, Isabel Arroyo heard about Chamacos and other studies finding similar outcomes. An organizer at El Quinto Sol de America, she says the data can help fill a gap regarding the health effects of pesticides in agricultural areas.
We never really talked about children, how it affects the children, until a report came out that we noticed that, oh my God, it is actually causing more issues than what we really thought. You know, it's linked to autism, it's linked to ADD, it's linked to asthma.
Chlorpyrifos, sold by Dow Chemical Company, is related to nerve gas used in World War II. Over 800 bug sprays, pet collars, and lawn products once contained this pesticide. In 2001, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, moved to protect children by banning in-home use, but the pesticide remains widely used in agriculture. So you won't find this chemical now in your can of bug spray. But farm workers and their children continue to be exposed to chlorpyrifos every day. Tulare County claims the lion's share of use for chlorpyrifos in California, although usage has declined here and across the country in the past decade. California, as an agricultural state, used over 1 million pounds of chlorpyrifos in 2012. That's about 20% of the nation's total. In Tulare, the main crops on which chlorpyrifos is applied are almonds, oranges, alfalfa, and cotton.
You know, if you go to your neighborhood and you talk to somebody and say, okay, do you know that the chlorpyrifos is being used and that it's a neurotoxin? They will tell you no. Do you know anything about pesticides? The only thing they'll say is like, yes, when I drive, I get drifted on sometimes.
In Tonyville, population 400, Arroyo takes me to an orchard where a crew is picking olives. One 18-year-old man says he's been working in the fields since he was a child in Mexico. He works year-round here in Central California picking different crops.
I found them in your car. I found them in your car, in your van.
Oranges are the most difficult to learn, he tells Arroyo. But the season lasts the longest. Orange crops in the state have been threatened by a tiny insect that causes greening disease. Chlorpyrifos is one of the pesticides used in treating infected trees. At the other end of this country road, Leticia Ceballos decided to plant an organic garden, but the water quality here is affected by the agricultural surroundings.
We keep getting notices from our water company that the water didn't pass, it didn't reach standards, and you can't drink it. So it is very difficult, even for the children.
Chlorpyrifos can travel from where it's applied through the air and the water, and it lingers. More than 3/4 of U.S. households had measurable amounts of chlorpyrifos 5 years after the ban for in-home use. So how are regulatory agencies protecting kids from the long-term effects of this pesticide? Tracy Brieger says they're not. As co-director of Californians for Pesticide Reform, she travels around the state to work with dozens of community groups, including El Quinto Sol.
So what we have across the state, and where you see this especially evident with chlorpyrifos, is a very big double standard, too, with chlorpyrifos, that you know, we've decided to protect children in homes, but we have decided not to protect children in rural communities.
And as Brieger points out, there are no standard protections or buffer zones regulating how close to schools pesticides can be applied. In 2011, three long-term studies, including Chamaco's, released papers charting exposures of women and their unborn children to pesticides called organophosphates. Chlorpyrifos belongs to this class of chemicals that affect the nervous system. Over a period of years, the researchers looked at brain development in the children, IQ, memory, and attention problems. Kim Harley, a Chamaco's researcher and professor at UC Berkeley, describes how they began studying the organophosphate pesticides.
What we didn't know when we started in 1999 and 2000, we didn't know what were the effects of ongoing chronic low-dose exposure to these pesticides, levels that were too low to really see overt effects, too low to take you to the emergency room, but ongoing exposure, especially to the most vulnerable people in society, and that would be the developing fetus and young children who are undergoing rapid brain development.
Chlorpyrifos works well on insects, but what are the effects on humans?
The way that they work, they kill insects because they target the nervous system of the insects and they basically shut down. They overexcite the nervous system and shut it down and it kills the insects. These organophosphate pesticides, including chlorpyrifos, act the same way on humans or the same way on all mammals. They target our nervous system.
Back in 1999, Chamacos began enrolling 600 pregnant women in Salinas, who mostly spoke Spanish. They'd been exposed to chlorpyrifos from bug sprays before the ban, and possibly in the fields where they worked.
Let me get them consented. I just do our logistical part. But you're
Marina Gomez, who was pregnant with Brian when she enrolled in Chamacos, had already worked in the fields for years. In this part of California, 8 or 9 different organophosphates are used in agriculture.
When they spray the pesticides, they always do it in the morning. If we come in at 7 in the morning, they stop us for just an hour, then they spray. Then after an hour, we start to work.
Chamacos has followed this original cohort of moms and kids for over 14 years, taking lots of lab samples and measurements along the way. The UC researchers released their findings on organophosphates in 2011.
What we found was that these associations that we see with children's brain development are really happening with the exposure, are really associated with the exposures to the moms during pregnancy.
Harley describes the range of brain effects.
The mothers with higher levels of organophosphate pesticides in their urine during pregnancy had children with more abnormal reflexes at birth, poorer mental development at age 2, more attention problems by age 5, and by age 7, when they're now in school age, lower IQ.
The findings are similar to two other studies from Columbia University and Mount Sinai Medical School, looking at the effects of organophosphates on unborn children. Although teasing out data can be complicated in epidemiological studies, the Chamagos results pointed to organophosphates as a primary culprit.
When we put other chemicals into our models, it didn't really change the association that we were seeing. For every 10-fold increase in organophosphate pesticide levels in a mother's urine during pregnancy, we see a 7-point decrease in IQ.
In 2012, the EPA's Scientific Advisory Panel on chlorpyrifos looked at these three landmark studies. They concluded that these studies strengthened the evidence for chlorpyrifos playing a likely role in the adverse effects in child neurodevelopment. But Jennifer Sass, a senior scientist at the Natural Resources Defense Council, NRDC, says despite their own panel's findings, the EPA has been ignoring this research.
No, they say they're not ignoring it. They say they're addressing it and they're discussing it in their documents, but it's not actually showing up in any of the numbers. At the very least, it should be showing up in the uncertainty factors, which should be much more protective than they are because of these data showing that kids in particular are exposed at much higher levels.
The U.S. EPA takes years to look at the health risks of each pesticide on the market as part of the registration process. In 2011, EPA released a human health risk assessment of chlorpyrifos. The final report is expected in late 2014. The health risk assessment has a lot of studies on rats and even discusses human studies sponsored by Dow Chemical in the 1980s and 90s. The companies have an incentive to fund this research, including experiments where people have been given pesticide doses without knowing the risks. The ethics are questionable. At Pesticide Action Network, senior scientist Margaret Reeves is critical of the industry's role.
It's hard for us to know what goes on behind closed doors at EPA. We know that EPA uses many of the industry-derived studies to make their decisions. That does not seem appropriate if you're asking the fox to guard the hen house, that you take the fox's information and to make decisions about what the best way is to guard the hens.
NRDC's SAS says chemical companies are too involved in that assessment process.
So the problem is that when EPA regulates a pesticide, by statute, by law, it can request and require data, toxicity data, from the registrant, which is the chemical manufacturer. What they require is the kinds of studies that EPA needs to generate a dose response calculation, which is a particular number. And the number is how much chemical or dose causes what kind of response.
After repeated requests for an interview, the EPA responded in writing, saying they intend to provide an opportunity for comment on a revised health risk assessment by the end of 2014. In 2011, the EPA proposed doing away with what's called a 10-fold safety factor designed by law to protect infants and children. It sets a wider margin of safety when you can't really figure out just how much or how little of a chemical is dangerous. There are plenty of unknowns supporting the higher safety standards, according to Reeves.
We see a much, much greater variation, much greater than 10 times, between the most sensitive infants and the least sensitive adults. There is a huge variation on the order of 100 times, as opposed to 10, between the least sensitive and the most sensitive individuals.
Pesticide Action Network and NRDC filed a lawsuit in 2007 and argued for an all-out ban on chlorpyrifos. The U.S. EPA still hasn't responded to the suit's key charges. Brieger, who heads Californians for Pesticide Reform, says decisions can languish in the back halls of agencies for years or even decades.
If there's no mandate to complete anything, and if particularly if there is political pressure to not complete it, sometimes you'll never see decisions actually ever see daylight again.
At the state level, industry can be a powerful influence as well. Reeves, with Pesticide Action Network, describes what happened in 2008 when California's EPA reviewed chlorpyrifos for inclusion on a list of chemicals that would receive warning labels because they're reproductive hazards.
all of the individuals with whom we had worked on biomonitoring studies and our wealth of information from the scientific literature, we got maybe 10 minutes of discussion. Dow was there in force and overwhelmingly demanded the time of the hearing of the panel.
In November 2008, a Cal EPA committee met to decide the status of chlorpyrifos, with compelling evidence presented by the agency's own scientists. Dow chemical scientists presented their arguments, including the claim that Chamaco's participants, Mexican-American women, did not represent the population of California. The committee voted against listing, and 6 years later, chlorpyrifos is still not part of the state's list of reproductive hazards.
The burden of proof is on the victims to demonstrate harm, and until the victims who do not have the resources, nor should they be obligated to do that, until the victims can demonstrate harm, the industry seems to be effectively off the hook.
Farmworkers' children are continually at risk of being exposed to what their parents bring back from the fields, which frequently surround their homes and schools. Dr. Valerie Bengel is well aware of the risks from pesticides. A family physician on the advisory board of Chamaco's, she says making a diagnosis can be complicated.
Unfortunately, some of these exposures are hard to separate from other factors in children's problems, and we even have trouble screening children adequately.
Ohlone Elementary School is located on a quiet country road in Watsonville, California, across from the field. Teachers are at the front lines of dealing with learning disabilities. Principal Brett Nuffer says the number one issue is poverty, and it's hard to trace those learning problems to pesticides when so many other challenges are at play.
We did try to sort those out as impediments to them being able to succeed in school from having a learning disability per se.
And even when families know about the risks of pesticides, it's not exactly easy to make changes. Marcy Mock has taught moderate to severely disabled kids at Ohlone for 12 years.
Most of our parents live out in the fields. I mean, their homes are in between croplands. So when they're spraying happening, it's happening within their home along with their work. And they're so on survival mode, they're not able to go and buck the system because they're just surviving.
During lunch, Casimira Salazar, the migrant ed teacher, says there are other reasons for the silence about pesticides.
Because a strawberry company, what's the name of the company here? Driscoll, they also give us money and give us backpacks. And so it's sometimes a conflict of interest to complain because this is where a lot of the parents work.
For Cynthia Fernandez, a second grade teacher, the concern about pesticides is also personal. Her son just finished kindergarten here.
So whatever I've been exposed to, he's going to also be exposed. And it's frightening.
In May 2014, California's Department of Public Health issued a detailed report on the pesticides used near schools in 15 agricultural counties. It's the first survey of its kind on the scale. Here in the town of Watsonville, most common are fumigants used in the strawberry business. At Ohlone School, a cheerful bunch of kids gather around a fenced-off gray metal box that's used for monitoring fumigant pesticides. Ohlone School is one of six sites in California with air monitoring equipment due to a lawsuit settled in 2011, where the U.S. EPA found that Latino school kids in the state were overly exposed to pesticides. Brett McFadden, chief financial officer of Pajaro Valley Unified School District, is keen on the monitoring program.
Let's be an active participant in collecting data. Let's look at the research. Let's talk to folks. Let's talk to our kids. Let's talk to our families that are impacted by all of this and find out what's going on with them. And through that, then we can make informed decisions.
The concern isn't just for farm workers' kids and communities. It's for everyone, says UC Berkeley's Kim Harley.
Chlorpyrifos and other organophosphate pesticides are used on food, and basically all of us in the United States have trace levels of it in our bodies. But obviously, we're most concerned about the children and the pregnant women that are living in agricultural communities that may have higher levels of exposure.
13 years after the U.S. EPA acted to remove chlorpyrifos from the home, there's no sign of a ban for agricultural use, says the NRDC's Jennifer Sass.
the pesticide manufacturers, the registrants, you know, have people here full-time whose job it is to go in and tell EPA what they think EPA should be doing. And so they're able to track and follow EPA, supply them their information at critical junctures, delay the process, and negotiate with EPA directly.
Californians for Pesticide Reform and dozens of community groups are calling on the state's Department of Pesticide Regulation to keep that tenfold safety factor and to ban the use of chlorpyrifos in California. Meanwhile, at the local level, groups like El Quinto Sol de America are talking to growers and public officials about safer alternatives. Isabel Arroyo.
How can we continue farming for 110,000 years, you know? And how can we get rid of these toxins that are bad for us? We need to make sure that eventually we can, you know, move away from chlorpyrifos.
For Making Contact, I'm Lee Miao Levitt in Tulare County, California.
This story was produced with support from the Fund for Investigative Journalism. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. Because of generous support from listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the US, Canada, Australia, and South Africa. To find out how to donate, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact.
You are listening to Making Contact. I'm Andrew Stelzer. We just heard a story about how regulation of chlorpyrifos has left certain populations behind, particularly farm workers and their children. Now we're going to talk about another pesticide, one you'll likely be hearing a lot about in the near future. It's called 2,4-D, and we have Mary Ellen Custin, Senior Policy Analyst with the Environmental Working Group, to talk to us about it. She's joining us by Skype. Welcome to Making Contact.
Thanks, Andrew. Great to be here.
So first of all, let's talk about 2,4-D. What sounds scary is that it was an ingredient in Agent Orange, which poisoned millions of Vietnamese and American soldiers in the Vietnam War. So what's the story here? Should that connection worry us?
Not as much as more recent versions and formulations of 2,4-D should. It was 2,4-D is half of Agent Orange, that's true, but the other half, 2,4-5-T, is actually the more toxic half. 2,4-D itself has been linked to some very serious health problems, including Parkinson's disease, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, thyroid issues, immune system issues, endocrine disruption, reproductive issues. I mean, it's very serious. And there's a proposal now by Dow AgroSciences, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of Dow Chemical Company, looking at the next generation of genetically engineered crops to be used with this old herbicide that's been around since the 40s. It is used in lawn and turf now, but it is not used as widely in agriculture. And the proposal would actually increase the amount of 2,4-D that's used by threefold to sevenfold by 2020. It would be sprayed on corn and soybean fields. Environmental Working Group, actually, we did an analysis that looked at how many elementary schools there are close to a corn or soybean field where this stuff would be sprayed. Dow Chemical themselves actually said in their proposal to EPA that this new formulation, this Enlist Duo is the name of the weed killer, would not drift more than 200 feet. But we found actually there are 500 elementary schools within 200 feet of a corn or soybean field in the country. And they're saying that this could, you know, be on those elementary schools harming children as they come in.
And this is connected to GMO corn and I guess GMO soy as well?
Correct.
How so? Can you kind of explain that? Because I the first time I heard about 2,4-D was through folks who are generally just concerned about genetically modified foods.
Yeah. So the seeds that Dow Chemical has produced, perhaps your viewers remember Roundup and Roundup Ready crops. So Monsanto created Roundup, which has glyphosate, which is half of Enlist Duo, this new weed killer we're talking about that would have glyphosate and 2,4-D in it. So when Roundup was put on the market in the mid-90s, Monsanto also created seeds that were tolerant to it. So they genetically engineered the actual corn to withstand being blasted by glyphosate. Similarly, Dow Chemical is now looking to do the same thing, but with 2,4-D and glyphosate. So this corn and soy has been genetically engineered to be tolerant of this new weed killer. So we could blanket the fields and the corn and soy would survive, where if it hadn't been genetically engineered, it would die.
And your report regarding the number of school children and schools that would be proximate to where 2,4-D might be sprayed, has it had much of an impact? Do you think it's going to affect the decision? I guess we're waiting to hear, we're in early August now, from both the EPA and the USDA about 2,4-D?
Correct, yeah. So we certainly have discussed it on Capitol Hill. We held a briefing at the end of July with prominent scientists and doctors and business leaders flagging the alarm, I mean, raising the alarm on how hazardous this will be to human health and the environment. And I mean, schools speak to people. So one of the things that EPA failed to do in their risk assessment of Enlist Duo with 2,4-D and glyphosate was look at the extra risk to children. And we showed that they should have, based on many studies, they should have increased the risk factor of 2,4-D. And so we're taking this information back to EPA. We've included it in comments to them. People have certainly rallied around it. I mean, more than 500,000 people across the country wrote in to EPA, signed petitions to EPA to say this is not a good idea. And whether you're a mom or a dad, an aunt or an uncle, or you were a kid ever in your life, I mean, this speaks to you, right? Like, this is powerful information to have kids being in the danger zone of 2,4-D near their schools.
Yeah, and that brings up a larger question. Earlier in our show, we heard another story about children in farm worker communities having their schools and homes near fields that are sprayed with pesticide chlorpyrifos. And now you've done this research about a 2,4-D and Enlist Duo, which may put many children in a similar situation. I'm wondering, on the regulatory side, why isn't children's health being prioritized?
EPA has actually been mandated by Congress. There was the Food Quality Protection Act said that when children were known to be at higher risks, a higher risk factor had to be factored into the amounts that would be allowed. And EPA failed to do that. So they did not follow the mandate that Congress gave them. It is very troubling. This really is the biggest decision of a generation that EPA is facing when it comes to known toxic defoliants, known harmful herbicides. And a lot is riding on this. I mean, an increase of up to sevenfold use of 2,4-D across the country, putting a lot of rural American children at risk, is really not worth it, and they need to consider it strongly.
Mary Ellen Custin is Senior Policy Analyst at the Environmental Working Group. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Andrew. It's been a pleasure.
And that's it for this edition of Making Contact. Check out our website, radioproject.org, to get a podcast, download past shows, or make a difference by supporting our work. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. The Making Contact team includes Lisa Rudman, George Lavender, Jasmine Lopez, Laura Flynn, Quan Booth, and Barbara Barnett. I'm Andrew Stelzer. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.